thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 108, recorded October 31st, 2014. Things That Go Bump in the Night, Copyright, Interviews, and Other Scary Things.
Well, welcome back to another episode of Digital Campus. This is our, I don't know if we've ever recorded on Halloween, so this may be our first Halloween edition. I'm Tom Scheinfeld at the University of Connecticut at Found History on Twitter, and I'm here with all the regulars here for this Halloween edition. Stephen Robertson, director of the Center for History and New Media. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Tom. Happy Halloween.
Sorry?
Happy Halloween.
Oh, thank you. Happy Halloween to you. Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Boo.
Boo. Whoa, I was frightened. Amanda French is with us. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
And Dan Cohen. Hey, Dan.
Hey, how's it going? I'm in full Halloween outfit, but unfortunately, this is just an audio podcast. Sorry.
This is the audience. The audio podcast format when it comes to Halloween. Does anybody have a anybody have a special costume that they're wearing today?
You know, I'm not wearing a costume, but I have to give a shout out to my younger son, who is America's fear of Ebola. He's wrapping himself in plastic and surgical gloves. He's going to wear his ski goggles and a surgical mask, and he's going to have signs all over him to say, "Don't touch me, keep away." And so I like the creativity there.
Anybody else dressing up tonight?
I'm dressed as a Gap employee right now.
I'm going to go see Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Lee Miller in a National Theater streamed version of Frankenstein tonight.
Wow!
So yeah,
very cool.
It's awesome. They switch roles as the creature and the Dr. Frankenstein, and so I've already seen one version with Cumberbatch as the doctor and Miller as the creature. And of course, they both play Sherlock Holmes in different series, so it's kind of, I don't know, it's all very much about intellect versus, you know, embodiment. And so I'm very excited about that. That's my Halloween thing. But I'm going to go in my normal clothes.
Well, I'm doing nothing quite so highfalutin for Halloween. I'm bringing my kids out, and my five-year-old has decided that we are all going to be the Avengers. So my two-year-old is Iron Man. The five-year-old is Captain America, and I'm Thor, complete with the long blonde wig, which for those of you who know what I look like will be interesting.
You should have plenty of— I'm Scheinfeld with hair.
Mm. I know. I may actually never take it off.
What's up? Well, you have company. My daughter's out there as a young Avenger character who I should know but don't. So comic book rather than movie version of it, and she's off to a superhero themed party with all of her senior high school classmates. So I think there may be another Thor out there to compare hairdos with.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to compete with the 18-year-old Thor. I think I'll stick with my 5-year-old's friends. All right, well, let's jump right in. We've got a couple of stories about collections and copyright this time around. And Dan, I think you just came from a meeting in Europe about the issue. Do you want to say a little bit about that before we jump into some of the current events?
Sure. Well, Digital Public Library of America, along with our partners at Europeana, the European aggregator of open cultural heritage collections across the continent, we had a meeting in Amsterdam to talk about the overall rights situation worldwide around historical collections, museum collections, archival material. And I'm sure our knowledgeable audience knows that it's a very, very complicated landscape. I think what we really tried to focus on were the rights statements themselves, the statements that are assigned to the millions of items that are on our site, now over 8 million on the DPLA site. And we did a little census of our rights statements to see what, you know, variability there was there, and also with the goal of trying to figure out how many of these items are actually sort of fully open. You know, they could be downloaded, they could be used in a paper or a book, they could be remixed in some way into a collage or an online exhibit that someone created, or they could be, you know, data mined or you know, manipulated in digital humanities ways. So we've been really looking at, you know, what we have and how the rights are kind of established for those. And what we found is that in the 8 million items we have 26,000 different rights statements assigned by the 1,300 collections that make up the DPLA right now. So it's insane sort of fractional differences between all of these things. Some of them in ways that are really hard to parse. I mean, we have some rights statements where I think the item is pretty clearly in the public domain. It might be from the 19th century, and yet the institution probably, you know, obviously inadvertently in a lot of cases when they just sort of go through by computer and assign rights to things, they might just add in a all rights reserved to an item when it really is in the public domain. So, and then there are just ones that are two paragraphs long about how you have to contact so-and-so and call this number and things like that. So it makes it very hard to do what is very easy on a site like Flickr, where you can say, you know, narrow this down by reusability. I only want to see those items that are Creative Commons licensed or those that can be used, you know, for educational purposes or things like that. And that's really where we want to go. And I think that will be really helpful to people in digital humanities if we had this massive collection where you could actually figure out what are the items you can reuse in multiple ways. So the meeting in Amsterdam really focused on how we can slim those down to a manageable number. 26,000 is not manageable. We think probably around 20 different rights statements will probably work globally, and they will range from very restrictive licenses, you know, in copyright. Obviously, we have a lot of material that's still in copyright, so we need to label it as such, and even more narrowly to say, you know, in copyright in a particular jurisdiction in the United States, you know, in France, those sorts of things, so that it's very clear to everyone. And then we'll have a spectrum ranging from that all the way to public domain, you know, fully open, you know, CC0, those kinds of things. We'll certainly be reusing some of the Creative Commons licenses as part of these 20. But the idea is that hopefully by, you know, this time next year, we will have implemented a much smaller set, and people will be able to sort of by faceted browsing or through our API, figure out materials not only from DPLA, but from other collections globally, like Europeana, and hopefully those in Australia and New Zealand and other partners that we have around the globe. They'll be able to scan all of those based on rights, not only based on subject matter. So, you know, it's a little bit inside baseball, but we think that, that rights are really critically important to all people, scholars, researchers, librarians, archivists, museum professionals. And it really is time to kind of button those down a little bit better than we really have online right now.
Yeah, it's a great effort. I mean, it's occurred to me before that, I mean, one of the wonderful things about the Creative Commons licenses, I mean, you know, we obviously all love open access. But in addition to that, it's just the kind of clarity with which they're written. I mean, maybe not the license themselves, but at least by which they're presented. You know, it's like, it's very easy to know what it is you can and can't do with them. And to kind of extend that clear accounting system out into the world of things that are not open, you know, fully open access or under open licenses seems like a really smart thing to do especially for you know, coordinating agencies, coordinating bodies like you work for, Dan. So that's really
yeah, and I should say that the idea would be that the goal would be that we'll have a global website that's you know, not owned by us at DPLA or by Europeana or Creative Commons, but is a kind of independent entity that will list these rights very clearly with clear URLs, you know, whatever the domain name is, slash, you know, public domain mark 1.0, just like Creative Commons has. And then that will take you to a page that will be multilingual, that will explain what the specific designation means, and what you can do with items under that designation, just like they have on Creative Commons site. In fact, we may reuse the Creative Commons method and website design.
Well, yeah. Dan, can I? That actually leads into a question I had, which is somewhat naive, and I think I may know part of the answer. But why do you need to develop this new schema of rights? Why not just use Creative Commons?
That is a great question. So the reason we need to do this is that, unlike Creative Commons stuff, like if you go to Flickr, you'll see that there are now, I think, 100 million photos Creative Commons licensed. And the reason they are licensed that way is that the photographers who posted those to Flickr own the rights to them. And so they can, as rights holder, assign a Creative Commons license to it, right? Creative Commons works within the copyright framework. What we have in DPLA, or what Europeana has, are materials that are not created by DPLA or by Europeana. They come from collections that also don't, in many cases, own the copyright. They're held by the estates of artists or authors, or they are just, you know, somewhere in the mist of time they were created, and we really don't have any clear rights designations on it. We have a lot of material that's in a kind of gray area. So you can't take those materials and Creative Commons license them. You can't take an orphan work and just, because you happen to be a library that holds that work, stamp it with a Creative Commons license. You do need to have the rights to that material. So we feel like this is very complementary with what Creative Commons is doing. If an institution does have the rights, we do encourage them to use one of the Creative Commons licenses. And indeed, I think we have about 10% of our collection that is Creative Commons license, but we have a whole mass of material that is actually kind of vaguely defined, and we just want to clear that up so that people can assign it a very specific right statement.
Were there, Dan, like sort of big points of disagreement that you had to work your way through on this?
No, I think actually everyone is pretty much on the same page. In fact, we did have a representative there from Creative Commons. I think the tricky parts are really the jurisdictional parts, so globally. So in the U.S., we are very fortunate, I think, to have a principle called fair use. And that means that we're very likely to have one of these 20 licenses be, if not solely devoted to that principle, certainly reliant on the American principle of fair use, where we might have a designation where it says, you know, the rights on this item are undetermined, but, you know, based on U.S. law, as a nonprofit institution, we are posting this material for educational use. I think we're likely to have something that looks a lot like that, and I think it's pretty clear. It's not, I think, an argument about it. It's just a difference that designation might be a lot harder to use in a place like Europe, where there are just, you know, different laws around it. There are also, in addition to the sort of legal rights, there are moral and ethical rights around cultural heritage items in most parts of the world that give, for instance, authors considerable leeway, even if an item is used for educational or non-commercial purposes. So it's those things that make this kind of work extremely difficult.
Yeah, that would certainly be my question. I mean, that you're doing this internationally on top of the normal challenges we have doing it within, you know, a single kind of legal code. If you can really genuinely boil it down to 20 across international jurisdictions, I think that would be an astonishing achievement.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be hard work. Europeana is working hard already with their partners to see how they can narrow them down into these distinct slots. I think probably inevitably we'll run into some problems, but, and I think some of the licenses, or they're really not licenses, they're really rights statements. So that's a little bit different than what Creative Commons is doing. But, we'll probably have to tweak the language on some of the rights statements. And we also probably will have to localize them, which Creative Commons does as well, even for some of their very broad licenses like CC BY, just the pure attribution license. There's versions of those that are unported that are sort of international, and there are versions of those that in fact are country or language specific that have little tweaks to them. Even public domain, you know, right now Creative Commons has one of their licenses is just a public domain mark. It's just a circle with PD in it. And what we discovered as part of this process is that what's PD one place might not be PD somewhere else.
Right. Yeah.
So there's material that is public domain in the US and is not in Europe. Books, for instance, you can have a book that goes way back into the 1870s that's still somehow in copyright in Europe. And so we need to be very careful about that. So I think really the process is about clarity and adding in, you know, we want in a sense the lowest common denominators, but we also know that we're going to have some specific country or regional specificity to these things as well.
Really, really interesting. Well, good luck, Dan, with dealing with all that complexity. I think while you were over in Europe dealing with the complexity of that situation, Harvard was here doing something that seems very simple, which is they've announced that they are... Oh, geez, my phone. Sorry. They've announced that they are going to allow... reproduction of works that are online, that their library provides online, that are published as in the public domain. They're going to allow users to reproduce those with no additional barriers or costs. I think, as we all know, that even when we come across items that where the originals are in the public domain, something from the 19th century, let's say, that the individual library, archive, or museum may put additional restrictions on the use of that item that you implicitly agree to by accessing the item, their digital reproduction of that item. Harvard has following Cornell and other libraries before them, made a statement that they won't put any additional restrictions on the public domain items that they make available online, which I think is a hugely positive development and something, I think, something of a trend amongst libraries and museums. Have people seen this in other places? I know Cornell, our friend, a friend of the podcast and irregular guest, Peter Hurdle, was the person who pioneered this at Cornell. Are there other places that have done similar things? Dan, you must know some of these.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really interesting and important about this is that a lot of institutions, again, I don't think it's in a malicious way, but they often, when they take a photograph of an item, they'll put rights restrictions around that photograph, even if the item is in the public domain. So what's really clarifying here is for Harvard to say, you know what, when we're taking a photo of an item that's in the public domain, we are also going to make that public in the public domain. You see this a lot, I think, particularly in museums. There's, you know, more restrictions around that. There have certainly been other techniques, like the Rijksmuseum, where they've made 200,000 artworks freely available. You know, I think this has had a very positive effect when, you know, there's more uses of that material. Again, it has a kind of clarifying effect so that people know what they can and cannot do around an item. But you'd be surprised. There's actually very few places that have made this very clear statement around these reproductions. And you know, I think there's a good case around it that they're really, you know, a so-called slavish reproduction of the original. And so, in a sense, don't have any artistic sweat of the brow kinds of things that would lead to more rights. But even beyond that, I think it really clarifies also that places like Harvard Library are in the business of maximal dissemination, even off of their website. And so it's an important statement to make, and we hope that a lot of other institutions will follow suit.
Right. So it's sort of making, in some ways, I mean, it's making clear something that is maybe already true. I mean, I know I ran into this with an article I wrote where I was... one of the illustrations for the article was a picture taken in the 1870s by a government photographer of the Smithsonian Castle building. So that was held in the Smithsonian Institution archives. So, I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find something kind of more public domain than that. And the publisher, you know, and I, you know, pulled it off the website and gave it to the publisher. And the publisher still wanted explicit permissions from the Smithsonian for to use that image, even though I explained, you know, this is public domain cubed. And so a statement like this, I think, would also send a signal to publishers who are, for real reasons, for real good reasons, cautious about treating anything as if it's public domain.
Right.
I'm just curious about whether this will send a signal to some of the cultural heritage institutions who do what you just described, because I think, you know, I come across this actually more working with students in teaching environments. The amount of public domain material out there in a digital copy where institutions are claiming rights over the digital copy is far more than I actually would have expected. And it does have a seriously kind of limiting effect on the use of that material. And I'm certainly in far less of a position than you are, Dan, to know just how intentional that is. In addition to the kind of the clarifying element of this, I'd love to see it as a kind of leading element, an opportunity to really ask people, you know, do you really want to restrict the circulation of this digital copy of a public domain record that you've made available? I mean, you know, what exactly is the gain versus the loss in the circulation and the reusability and all of those things that I think we are now at least expecting cultural heritage institutions to value as much as whatever they would gain out of restricting and licensing that material. And I don't know whether Harvard is a natural leader for most of those kinds of organizations. But I think, you know, I do find myself constantly scratching my head about, you know, the abundance of public domain material that has been copied and made available digitally and yet is not actually really available to the huge number of people finding it who would like to at least be confident that they're using it in a legal way. And, you know, we want our students to be, and therefore I'm quite scrupulous with them for looking for permissions and not letting them, you know, think too much about the grey area of those permissions. So I don't know, is this an opportunity for people to reevaluate what they're doing?
Well, I think it's interesting that it's the Harvard Library and not necessarily the Harvard Museums, because I feel like where this often becomes more of an issue is in museums. There have been many...
Especially fine art collections.
Fine art collections rather than history museums. We have... There's been lots of sessions at that camps about this, and of course the people who are really conversant with digital norms are all in favor, usually, of making what are often called digital surrogates of public domain material, themselves public domain. But it is the case that for many museums, they see it as a revenue stream. And there are studies that say, well, in fact, you know, at best, it's cost replacement. And, you know, in other cases, there are really good reasons to provide even high resolution images, although not always the high resolution images, but at least some kind of image of these public domain materials without restriction. So I don't know. We'll see. I think in a way, I was surprised that there wasn't this policy already at Harvard, because it has been a leader in some ways, particularly with the work of Peter Suber, not Peter Hurdle, in open access materials. But I'm, you know, we'll see. I would like to see museums adopt this kind of policy more explicitly.
Yeah, Dan, do you have any idea how much Harvard thinks they might be giving up by doing this? You know, was there a revenue stream, and if so, how big was it?
Oh, I don't think there was a revenue stream at all. I think it was probably, you know, as with most places, there's, you know, probably some risk aversion there. They worry about labeling something as a public domain that it turns out it's not, and there's lawsuit risks, and they're a big institution, and so, you know, there are probably pieces like that, and then there's probably stuff that's... again, what I would consider also like non-malicious, which is, you know, there's just inertia around these things. Like some of the content management systems that they drop these things into just automatically add a little, you know, write statement at the bottom that's just automated, and the code isn't exactly like checking the dates on the item or checking the write statement around the item. So, you know, these are common things that I think we all encounter. And so I just think it needs to be this little extra effort to ensure that this stuff is in the public domain. And I also think more stories like the creative uses that, that happen when large collections of public domain images go up would be helpful. I think that the one that comes to mind from 2014 is both the Internet Archive and the British Library posted hundreds of thousands, or I think millions, of images from 19th century books up on Flickr. And people have been using those in really fascinating ways. There have been some digital humanities type research on trends in those images. And the New York Public Library started using some of those images to create covers, sort of an automated public domain book cover system, where they pull an image from those collections and then add some color into it and add the title and author to the book and make a nice looking cover for some of these books that, in fact, we have in the DPLA that just have, you know, what looks like a fax cover because it's just the title page.
And of course, Mark Sample made a Twitter bot, which I follow, which is called Old Book Picks.
Yes, and that's great. Like, it's really great fun. You find all these, you know, sort of serendipitous discovery of these things. So I think there needs to be more of that. And then I think that will also prod people a little bit more to see what can happen when they do properly label these things.
Well, keeping with the copyright theme, and Stephen, you mentioned students explicitly and how navigating these waters with students and in our teaching can be especially difficult. A story that we've been following for, like 5 years at least, raised its head, its very ugly head again. The Georgia State e-reserves case popped up again in the news. Mills, you want to tell us a little bit about the latest in that ongoing debacle?
Yeah, I feel like we need to like overlay in the background some like music from Psycho or something like that. Since it's Halloween and it's just like, this is like that's what I was thinking. I mean, this is like the zombie case that just it's turning into the next Google Books case. It just won't, you can't kill it off. And I feel most sorry for Judge Arinda Evans at the U.S. District Court in Georgia, who issued this 350-page opinion back in May of 2012, in which she tried to navigate her way through this lawsuit by the publishers of various, this Association of Publishers. Actually, it was three academic publishers, Cambridge, Oxford, and Sage, who sued Georgia State saying that their electronic reserve policy was violating the copyright of these the works that were being provided to students. And so this case went on for a very long time and was finally decided back in May of 2012. And the judge ruled that out of 75 alleged copyright infringements, that only five of them actually were. And of course the publishers appealed because, if I was a publisher, I would have appealed because this would be really bad for my business model. So they appealed and it went on to the Court of Appeals in Atlanta, and they unanimously reversed Judge Evans' ruling. However, it's really interesting when you read about it, because what they essentially said, she had four, standards that she applied in her decision: the purpose and character of the use, in this case teaching, the nature of the copyrighted work, what was it, the amount and substantiality of the portion taken, was it 10%, was it 20%, was it a whole chapter, was it how many sonnets in a total collection, that sort of thing. And then what was the market harm? What was the effect on the publisher of this use? And so what the Court of Appeals said was that she had been too narrow in her defining the substantiality of the portion taken, that what amount of the work, that she'd applied too narrow of a standard to that, but had not taken a broad enough view of market harm. And so they sent it back to her and said, essentially, try again. And so that's what this poor judge in Atlanta is now going to have to do, is go back and revisit her 350-page opinion and try to decide how to re-rule on a case that she's already ruled on. The publishers are, I'm sure, happy about this because they will see it as a victory for their side. And Georgia State, for sure, will be unhappy because not only will they see it as a loss, but also an under-resourced university is now going to have to continue to fight a very expensive legal battle that they thought they had won. Those are the principal players in the case. The bigger issue really is, these are proxies for the publishing industry and for educators, and Georgia State just happens to be, holding the, carrying all the water for everybody else. So this is, I'm sure this is going to have a huge chilling effect on university libraries all around the country. This is a ruling, obviously, that only applies in the United States, but it's going to have a chilling effect at libraries all around the country because they're going to now, once again, be really worried that they're in some ways violating, and not just libraries, but, if faculty members who are putting work into their content management systems and websites or however they're posting it, and worried that they could be sued under whatever the new version of the ruling is. So here we go again.
It is. I mean, it's really hard not to feel bad for Georgia State and all this. I mean, you really feel like they are the one left standing in the game of musical chairs. Like, everybody's doing this, but they're the ones who got called out when the music stopped. And yet, as you say, Mills, to be fighting for an urban public university like that, to be fighting with the entire publishing industry, just is just an awful position to be in. And I hope for them that it's resolved favorably, but also resolved soon.
Go ahead, Amanda.
Oh, just that there was a story recently about the cost of journal subscriptions. Somebody filed a Freedom of Information Act in the UK, which struck me as an extremely good idea to get some sense of the cost of journals, because usually these things are covered by contracts, right? So they can't be discovered. But nevertheless, in this story, it was discovered that Oxford University Press, in particular, which was one of the parties to this case against GSU, the price paid to them by UK institutions rose by 50% just in the last 4 years, since 2010 and 2014. I don't think that's, profits or whatever, but say if they were paying, if a university was paying $100,000 to OUP in 2010, well, now they're paying $150,000, which is an enormous amount over the, course of 4 years. So anyway, yeah. I just want to underline the point that GSU is not a big school. It's not Emory. It's as you said, an urban public institution. And OUP is a mammoth, let alone the other publishers that are ranged on the other side of this. So it doesn't surprise me in a way that they got that fourth factor of market harm to be taken a little more seriously.
Well, and I just did I think it's not entirely coincidental that the publishers decided to pick on an institution like Georgia State, which is a very similar institution to George Mason, where we are, a new university with very few resources. And so I just did a quick calculation of the sort of back of the envelope calculation of probably about how much income Georgia State's endowment generates on an annual basis. And that's probably just a little over $5 million a year from their endowment. That's if the endowment is performing at its full 5% rate, which is pretty standard for endowments. So about $5 million a year. I suspect that the legal costs from this case are approaching the seven figures to begin with. And so, now there are plenty of universities with multi-billion dollar endowments who I suspect could equally have been singled out for this lawsuit. And, it's just...
They should start a Kickstarter. We could all donate to it.
Yeah, it's actually not a bad idea. I mean, because we are all going to... well, hopefully benefit from the successful outcome.
So I just posted something on One Remedy. I posted something on Twitter just a minute ago, and that is, you know, one of the ways that we as faculty members can help deal with this is, oh, shocker, keep copyright of your own work. So, for instance, my most recent book, which the University of Michigan Press, I want to give a shout out to them, they were willing to let me hold the copyright on the book. And so I posted a picture of my copyright page in case anybody doubts it. It's copyright Mills Kelly. So, you know, and it's licensed under Creative Commons. So that's one way we deal with this in the long term. In the short term, it's going to just, we're going to have to wait for the legal opinions.
Well, and the loss of the 10% one chapter formula is a part of this that I think is going to be really disruptive. I mean, in using that, in the decision, they were using a formula that appears everywhere, and kind of throwing that back down to the judge, and, you know, insisting on you know, all of these factors being raised holistically. You know, one of the few kinds of planks of clarity out there has kind of been taken out from underneath people as well. I mean, I just don't, you know, why this is in limbo. There's just so little for anybody to hang their hat on in terms of being confident about what they're doing. I think it's, you know, I mean, I think the market impact is, I mean, most of the coverage says that this is sort of a mixed result, something for both sides. But it is hard to imagine how, with the formula going, really does balance more market impact when you know, that's the one that is most straightforward, I think, for the publishers on this side to argue that there is some kind of market impact from these sorts of practices. So it just seems to me that there's a lot less clarity, and I'm not sure that it's all that positive in terms of where this seems to be heading.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because I used to believe, too, that the four-factor test for fair use and so on was a pain, and, you know, why can't it just be like a speed limit where you're either going 55 or not? But actually, in some sense, clarity is not what people want. Like, the publishers actually said, oh, we just want like a 10% rule. Like, you can't use more than 10% of the work. But it's really, librarians, even though it is a lot of labor to kind of clear these things and to figure out, oh, is this or is this not fair use, and it's never quite sure, they really do want to consider things on a case-by-case basis, because so often it's, you know, a percentage basis just doesn't represent what, particularly if you're talking about text works, what you might want to use or what would actually genuinely affect market harmony. But anyway, my thinking on that has changed a little bit, where I feel like lack of clarity may actually be a good thing.
Except when you're dealing with increasingly risk-averse institutions who, in the face of lack of clarity, will go to the extreme. Looking for clarity. I mean, we are encountering this more and more, not just on these kinds of issues, but on a range of other issues to do with ADA compliance and online security that institutionally, they don't want to take any risks at all. So, yeah, why at a broader conceptual level, I'd entirely agree with it, Amanda. I think on a day-to-day basis, lack of clarity is going to turn into a quite restrictive sense of clarity in the hands of a lot of the institutional decision makers that we deal with in these kinds of processes.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this case, as we have been for many years, and we'll be sure to give all of you, our listeners, an update when we get some of that long hoped for clarity. Sort of final story for this time around. I'm going to take it a little bit further inside the diamond for some inside baseball about the way that we interview for academic positions. And we saw this week that Rosemary Feil of the MLA has called for, sort of startlingly, for the institution that she represents, a change in the way that we interview humanists for tenure-track jobs, to take that interview process away from the annual meetings of the big scholarly associations, the MLA and the AHA, and to do it in some other ways, including some ways that employ digital technology. Amanda, you've been following this. You want to give us a little bit of an update on what Rosemary's thinking and where you think this is going?
Absolutely. So first, I guess I would have to correct you a little bit. Rosemary Fayal, executive director of the MLA, published a column which is openly available on MLA Commons, and then, you know, it's part of the winter newsletter. And I guess I would have to say it's not exactly that she's saying don't interview at the conference, interview by Skype, but she's really calling for people to make, you know, an explicit decision about where they want to interview and why, and very much recommending that above all, departments should not put as much of a burden on candidates as they do. So this column, which I'm sure we'll link to in the show notes, she points out that just as a matter of fact, the MLA itself has no interest in making the annual conference a site for job interviewing, that there is no financial interest, you know, that the conference is not a source of major revenue for the association. You get sort of uninformed people all the time going, oh, the MLA is making money off of exploiting graduate students, and that's just not the case. You know, that it's you know, the MLA represents, you know, language and literature scholars and faculty at all levels. So, you know, it has many members who are on the search committees as well as many members who are graduate students who have been sort of culturally required to go to the conference in order to interview. So, you know, she points out that departments want to do this. This is, you know, sort of an inertial practice to where it used to be the sort of best way of, you know, for certainly for the departments to interview a number of people at one time. But she points out that remote interviewing is increasingly common already, and that, you know, there are other ways to do it besides Skype, which can be unreliable. I think that's a little hilarious myself. I'm like, well, yes, Skype is unreliable, but it's not that big a deal, you know. It crashes, you know, you restart it, you know, why? But I understand that interviews are tense anyway. So the MLA has put out guidelines for doing remote interviews by technology. I think that even if Rosemary is not saying, you know, we're banning all interviewing at the conference because it does make the conference such a tense place. I think that would be a foolish thing for her to say, and she's not saying that. But she is saying, look, really look at how you interview, and there are benefits to doing it remotely by technology. You could interview more candidates, right, up front. If you do it that way, you can, you know, and there are so many applicants for so many of these positions, that's probably a very desirable thing. So I just think it's a really positive development. I think it was much retweeted on Twitter, including by historians, including Jeff McClurkin. And I think a lot of people would really get behind this, and I hope hiring departments do as well.
Do you think that this extends to other disciplines? I feel like there are some disciplines that, like econ history, very likely really do depend on that that hiring market to get a lot of people to the conference. Am I wrong about this? I mean, I wonder if MLA is like slightly different in the nature and vibrancy of the annual meeting. Not that, for instance, the HA meeting isn't vibrant. It certainly has lots of great sessions, but I do feel like I've certainly bumped into people there who say, oh, I'm only here because I'm on a hiring committee.
Plenty of people say that at MLA too. So you're the historian. Yeah. You guys can tell me about AHA and other scholarly associations. But the thing is, I've been going to MLA a lot for the last few years, and I have neither been on the job market nor interviewing. And I really go for the intellectual content, which
right.
is
well, that,
not
that's
everybody
awesome.
Does.
That's
but it's like
yeah.
it's like my annual DH conference. You know, that's where I get to hang out with all of my digital humanities peeps. And it's certainly less expensive than the annual ADHO conference, and sometimes that's in Australia and whatever. So, although I like that conference too. So,
I mean, my sense of AHA is that the number of job interviews that have been done at AHA has been declining fairly precipitously. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the old cattle call style, you know, on-site interviews that weren't done in advance and were put up at the conference. And
right.
you know,
still people, happens.
Yeah, though very, very small numbers, I think. And I think, you know, with the shrinking job market on top of that, I think I can't imagine that an enormous proportion of what goes on at AHA is tied to the job market. I can certainly imagine that that has been true in the past. But, I mean, you know, without wanting to promote the AHA conference, certainly generationally, there's a sizable attendance at the AHA conference of people who go anyway. You know, I'm often struck by the fact that AHA doesn't look like the profession as it gathers in other kinds of situations. So I think there's a portion of people who go because it's the AHA, regardless of whether they're involved. And I don't know quite how that breaks down, but my sense is that the conference has stayed big even as the market's got smaller.
Yeah, okay, so I have like really strong opinions on this subject. And I'm so happy about the MLA taking this position because, I mean, I can remember not that long ago at an AHA meeting seeing some poor job candidate being interviewed in the Starbucks at the Marriott Woodman Park here in Washington. And I wanted to walk up to the people who were interviewing her and say, "What's wrong with you?" Mm-hmm. You know, it was absolutely despicable that they were doing that. And she was terrified. And it was just the worst of the worst. Now, why were they doing that? Well, probably because they were from an under-resourced history department that couldn't afford an interview suite. Thank God they don't interview in hotel rooms where candidates have to sit on beds anymore like we used to. I've sat on a bed in an interview at the AHA. That's pretty bad too. And so at least that doesn't happen so much anymore. But the Starbucks, really? I mean, that's about as bad. That's, in its own way, that's as bad as forcing a candidate to sit on a bed while talking to potential colleagues. So the issue is, you know, attendance at the annual meetings, okay, it's not... the annual meeting is a source of revenue for most membership associations, and I don't know about the American Historical Association what percentage of their income that represents, but it's some source of income. And hiring committees are typically send, you know, three people, and so that's a source of revenue. It's wrong to require contingent faculty who make almost nothing and graduate students who make even less to come to these sorts of interviews to at the annual meeting. So it's going to be in New York this year. New York City is not an inexpensive place to spend even 24 hours. So the annual meeting for the American Historical Association in 2012 I'm looking it up right now. The annual meeting, $973,000, and the cost were $727,000, so about $200,000 in revenue for the association. So, so that's a chunk of money out of a, you know, total budget of a little over $303 million. So it's not inconsequential. I'm speaking to you from a history department that no longer interviews in that way. We interview everybody over some sort of teleconference facility.
Unless the meeting's in Washington, D.C.
Unless the meeting's in Washington, D.C. And I would vote tomorrow that even if it were in Washington, D.C., we should interview everyone in that way because it does level the playing field. Because you can go to a Kinko's or, you know, a local office place that does teleconference, you can Skype, and you know, and we interview. So I was on a search committee 2 years ago or 3 years ago now, where we were hiring for just an entry level assistant professor position, and so we interviewed 10 people through that kind of teleconference, and it was great. And one of the people, and this was not Skype, one of the people's connection went bad at their end, and they started pixelating really badly, and so badly that we had to finally say, we can't continue to look. We tried rebooting a couple of times and it didn't work. So we can't continue to look at the pixelated version of you. It's too disconcerting. And so we're going to switch to audio only. And okay, did that harm him? No, he was one of their on-campus finalists. And so, because he really stood out, he was great, you know. And
actually, sometimes grace under pressure can stand out. I mean,
heck yeah.
But it was really, you know, he was just a really interesting candidate, and so the fact that he turned into this like weird pixelated monster on screen did not prevent him from getting one of our three on-campus interviews.
That's an awesome trick, in fact. You can do that in front of a class and, you know, hold everybody's attention.
So, I think I'm totally in favor of the MLA version of this. I think everybody should be interviewed through some sort of teleconference, whether it's Skype or telepresence or, you know, whatever.
Well, and again, I would point people to their recommendations, which I think are really great. Maybe I shouldn't scoff so much about, like, what's wrong with Skype. But, yeah, what they do recommend is that, like, you look into higher-level on-campus teleconferencing things and do a little test with the candidate beforehand to make sure that they've got the technical side set up as best as possible. So,
I mean, I was on both sides of this. I mean, I did a couple of Skype interviews for my job here at the center, and then I was on a search committee that Mason sent to the AHA in Washington. And I've got to say that, you know, I really didn't think we got any more out of being in a hotel suite with the candidate than we got out of being able to see them through Skype. I mean, you know, when the alternative was a telephone interview, that was a different story. I hate telephone interviews both ends. I think it's really important for people who are talking to each other to be able to see each other. But when you can see each other through Skype versus seeing each other in a hotel suite, I just really didn't see any real advantage to being in the room other than kind of all the awkwardness that goes with getting in and out of spaces and all of those kinds of things. I mean, I think I absolutely agree with Amanda. I think that the technical challenges are kind of oversold, and I think actually the reality is you can get all the things that are important about being face to face with somebody through Skype. I mean, I just really didn't experience a significant difference in the kinds of conversations and things that I was involved in on Skype versus in the hotel suite.
It also makes it possible to consider candidates from all around the world for preliminary interviews, as opposed to saying, "Oh, well, we're really interested in Dan, but you know he lives in Amsterdam, and we just can't fly him over for a preliminary interview, or we can't ask him to come over for a preliminary interview. So we'll do face to face with everybody else, and then we'll just talk to Dan on the phone." Mm-hmm. Talk about an unlevel playing field. Mm.
Though I did do my Skype interviews at 10:30 at night, so it's still not an entirely level playing field, depending on how far removed you are in time zone things. But yeah, it's certainly that's preferable to the to not being involved.
There's no help for Australians. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, we will definitely link to those suggestions, those MLA guidelines, and Rosemary's column in the show notes. That's about all we've got time for. I want to thank all you guys. Great to talk to you again. I also want to thank our graduate student producers, Jordan and Janelle, for this week. Thank you guys for putting these stories together and making sure we sound good and cutting out any mistakes we made. Hint, hint.
And can I just give a little shout out? I was at a sort of a conference at Dartmouth recently and ran into a Digital Campus fan. I always like to give shout outs to them. So shout out to Alan Riddell.
Nice.
Dartmouth, who said he's a fan of the podcast, and he's got a really interesting novels project there, which is at novels.ariddell.org, two D's, two L's, where he's doing some sort of, I guess you can call it, just analysis and distant reading about a couple thousand Victorian novels. So.
Excellent. Well, thanks for listening, Alan, and we will definitely link to your project in our show notes. For Stephen, Mills, Amanda, and Dan, I'm Tom Scheinfeld. This is Digital Campus, and we'll see you guys next time, probably, hopefully, from the 20th anniversary of the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media celebrations later in the month.
We have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
Thank you.